outside my house. Like,
it sure seems that way.
Well, there's always an ambulance across the street, like a couple times a week.
Oh.
So I'm wondering if that's what it is. They're not getting loud enough to where it seems like they're there, but they're stopping, like, right.
It seems like they've got somebody almost pulled over on the street out here. Hey, we're podcasting here. What's up? This is Movies On Up. This is not a game. This is my co-host, Mr. Dave Bisella.
Gamey as usual.
Game for another episode.
Yeah.
How about that?
Oh, yeah. I'm game for Yep. I'm game for this.
I'll edit that together so it sounds like you came up with that all by yourself. That's Mr. Dave. I am Ryan. We are Movies On Up. This is not a game is our tagline for this week. A very apropos tagline for this week. If you think you know what movie that comes from, send your guess to us in one of the following ways. You can email us moviesonup@gmail.com. You can leave it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviesonup, or tweet your guess at us via Twitter @moviesonup. If you are correct and if we choose you, you will be the winner of our tagline game for this week.
If you know what movie is not a game, you will ender up with a prize pack.
Yes, very good. You are certainly taking off the beginning of the podcast, getting ready for just that. There when I need him is Mr. Dave. This week, we needed an idea for a movie episode that we could tie into Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. We could have gone a lot of ways. We could have done any of the seemingly dozens of movies that get referenced in the movie Ready Player One. It does have a bit of 80s nostalgia to it. We could have done Tron, a fella getting sucked into a video game. We did figure that most of you, or enough of you, have probably at least familiar with Tron, that maybe that was not the way we wanted to go. But Dave, I think Dave has been trying to come up with an excuse for us to do a Last Starfighter episode for a while. The kid plays an arcade game. He's very good at it. Now, it goes a different way than Ready Player One does, but...
And it's 80s. Yes. It's the kind of 80s nostalgia that Ready Player One thrives on, but not specifically Last Starfighter.
I would be very shocked if there were a Last Starfighter reference in Ready Player. There might be.
But it's that 80s sci-fi fantasy that Ready Player One thrives on. And I feel like The Last Starfighter is a perfect example of that without being an obvious one.
I think that's the key, without being obvious. It was a movie that Dave and I had both liked from our childhoods, but I hadn't seen it, I would say, in at least 20 years, maybe even longer than that. So we were both kind of curious as to if we would still like it the same now.
20 years seems like a long time when you say it like that, but it's probably been...
20 years is like 1998.
Yeah, which is scary.
I know.
But it's probably like 15. I've probably seen it in the last 10 to 15 years, which is still a long time. So I was excited to rewatch it because it is one of those I have such fond memories of. And a lot of those movies that I have fond memories of and I don't know if they'll hold up, I'll avoid watching because I don't want to sour those memories.
Right.
So it was one of those, do I want to watch it or do I just want to keep those memories? And I like the idea of doing this episode because it was an excuse to watch it again. And I was excited to watch it again.
Specifically, you with kids of an age that might begin to appreciate that movie. Like, that's kind of another reason that, like, oh, hey, this is something from my childhood that, you know, you could share.
Especially Grayson. Grayson's a video gamer. Like, he plays games more than I ever have or ever will. So it was easy to sell him on it. Like, hey, guy plays video game and then gets sent into space to fight wars. He was into it, but it was a bit too 80s for him.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, when you talk about 80s, it came out in 1984. It was directed by Nick Castle, starring a very 80s cast. Lance Guest, Dan O'Herlihy, Catherine Mary Stewart, who Dave and I were just talking about, shows up.
Night of the Comet.
Same year, basically same wardrobe. She's very 80s herself, and Robert Preston. It opened to just over $6 million on July 13th, 1984, which was good for third place this weekend. It was only about $160,000 behind Gremlins and $3 million behind Ghostbusters. You know, we've talked about how great 1984 in terms of movies was for the two of us. Gremlins is one of Dave's all-time favorites, and he likes Ghostbusters an awful lot, too. And Ghostbusters is probably top three.
Like, that's just one of those where, like, I want time travel. I would just camp out at a movie theater all day and see all three of those.
And let me add two more.
Because there's also Indiana... was
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yes, Temple of Doom was in there.
That was a little bit later on, I believe. Karate Kid was in theaters that week, as well as Muppets Take Manhattan. Those are your top five. I liked the Muppets. If that's the fifth in a quintuple feature, yeah, I'm okay with that. I mean, I do love Gremlins, do love Ghostbusters. And even Karate Kid, I've watched a lot as an adult. They all hold up.
I saw all of those in the movie theater except Muppets. I was five.
I was born in April of that year, so like I would have been a couple months old. I saw none of them in the theater.
I might run into myself if I go back in time and see those movies.
Oh, that would be weird. You just can't occupy the same space at the same time, I think. Last Starfighter went on to gross $28.7 million domestically, which puts it at number 2,680 on the all-time domestic list. It is one spot below this 2001 John Singleton-directed Tyrese Snoop joint.
Oh, that Baby Boy.
Yes, Baby Boy indeed. And it is one spot above the Diane Lane, Colin Hanks cyber thriller.
I know it. I've seen it. It's a one-word title.
It will be unbelievable if you get this right.
Untraceable.
Yeah, untraceable. Yeah. Very good. I thought to myself,
Colin Hanks dies in that.
Spoiler alert. This would be a very difficult double feature for you to get, but you got it. That's very impressive. Just to give you some context, also from 1984, John Carpenter's Starman is about four spots higher.
Another awesome movie that I don't know if it holds up. I haven't watched it in a long time.
Point Break is three spots higher than that. The remake, not the original, exactly. And a movie that we talked about a couple weeks ago, Angelina Jolie's Oscar performance in Girl Interrupted, is at 2664 all time. Now, you talked about movies that I would go back to 1984 and watch in the theaters right now. Karate Kid, Ghostbusters, Gremlins. The outlier there would be Last Starfighter. None of the rest of those movies require or rely heavily on digital effects. There's certainly some in Ghostbusters, but the Gremlins were practical. A lot of the stuff with Ghostbusters was models. And
Karate Kid was all practical.
Yeah, all practical. From what I understand, Ralph Macchio did his own stunts. I don't know. But that stuff was all done and shot. And I think that's what gives us both pause on Last Starfighter, because it was so effects heavy. When I sat down with Sarah to watch this movie, she said, well, how old is it? And I said, well, it's from 84. And she goes, I hate these movies. And I was like, well, what do you mean? Specifically, it's movies from the 1980s that seem dated. And this movie, The Last Starfighter, it kind of holds a bit of a historical place in terms of CGI and its use in film. It is the first time that a computer was used to render something that was supposed to be real. And that was the Gunstar, I believe, is what it's called. All of the spaceships, for the most part, were digitally created, whereas, like with Star Wars that we had seen in the past, those were models. So your TIE fighters were actually models on a wire. These were real things. At the very least, that was something that in 1984 we hadn't seen before.
Looking back, I could see it being hard if you lack that perspective, but you look at the video game that he plays. I remember playing arcade games like that. I remember playing Atari. It was very Atari-like.
The first Star Wars game was very much like that.
Yes, it was very much like arcade games that I played when I was little. So when it gets to the digital effects and stuff, it does feel like you're sucked into a video game, essentially. But at that point, video games didn't look that good yet. So, I mean, that would have been amazing for a video game to look like that. We were a few years away from video games looking as good as they do here. In that aspect, it looked good. It did look like you were pulled into a video game that was hyper-realistic at that time, because video games did not look like that.
It's hard to talk about this movie with video games and that being so central to the plot and not talk about Tron from 1982, which is just a couple years before that. But if you look at Tron, the 80s, that's the arcade boom. That's Asteroid Centipede. And Tron was about a guy that gets sucked into an arcade game. That movie was backed by Disney, which certainly was not quite what it is right now. And I don't even think that's much of a stretch to say that. But even Disney's Tron only grossed about $4.3 million more. But each, I think, have a cultish following.
Oh, yeah.
Amongst guys of our
generation. We talked about this as kind of a flash in the pan, because Tron, at least Jeff Bridges was in it, who's still a big star, who's went on to have an awesome career. So when you look back, it's like, oh, that's cool. That's like him early. And then whereas Last Starfighter doesn't have that. You don't have a director that really made an impact. The writer really didn't do much else other than Theodore Rex. And Lance Guest didn't really do anything. So it's just a snapshot. I don't think I'm making my point, but like even E.T., like, oh, there's a young Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
Younger Steven Spielberg. There's stuff that's relevant now, and you can see why it's nostalgic. Last Starfighter, it's a snapshot of that time frame.
Very much. Snapshot is the perfect, because it's separate. E.T., I think, you know, the ride still, well, was when I was at Universal, that E.T. ride is still there. Tron, for better or worse, had a sequel that came out a couple years ago. Last Starfighter was made into a musical for its 20th anniversary. There's been some different adaptations of it, but I think, not that I want to define what is and what is not a cult movie, because I think that almost is different depending on the genre and depending on who you talk to. But I think this is a great example of a cult movie. It was financially successful, which usually would disqualify you from being a cult movie. I mean, Night of the Comet, I think, is a cult movie. But it's one of those that I think somehow has flown under the radar, and maybe over time this movie has been cast into the cult status. But like you said, there's no reason, if you were a fan of Drew Barrymore, maybe you're going to go back and watch all her movies. Or Steven Spielberg, one of the biggest directors of our lifetime. He's still making movies, so maybe you want to go back and watch Spielberg movies you missed.
In fact, he's got one coming out this week.
Yeah, which is probably the reason we're doing this. But Nick Castle is not doing that. There's no major Payne fan that's saying, I have to watch every movie directed by Nick Castle. Other than Lance Guest's parents, you're probably not going to go watch all his movies. So if you love Last Starfighter, it's not the sum of the parts, it's the product.
I think Robert Preston is probably the most impactful. This was, I think he only had one or two more.
One of
he
his died last movie
two years
roles.
Later.
Yeah.
So it is just a snapshot. It's just one of those things where there's the pieces just happen to work together, and it created something special.
One of the pieces of this movie, and we have mentioned it already, I believe it's the star of the movie, is the technology. Sarah does bring up a valid point about how technology does tend to age in movies. There's some movies, maybe a little bit like Tron, but more specifically, I think Jurassic Park and Terminator 2, the older they get, it's almost more impressive that, of what
how
they are.
How good they still
Jurassic
look.
Park was 1993.
And it still looks amazing.
Photorealistic CGI. When we did our Jurassic Park episode a couple of years ago, it's you remark at how long it's been, and it still looks phenomenal. Last Starfighter, it doesn't hold up quite the same. It doesn't look as good as newer movies. But seeing that with 1984 eyes, in Dave's case, or as close to 1984 eyes as I could come, I do think it was mind-blowing. I mean, kids nowadays are used to Avatar and Lord of the Rings, but that kind of tech wasn't available in the 80s. The Last Starfighter's effects were made on a computer that had about 1 gig of physical memory and 4 64-bit processors. I think I read the manual, but it was written in 1984 computer language. I don't understand it. It's got magnetic tape it uses.
The phone you're listening to this on has way more power.
Yes, much more power.
More power.
And Tron specifically was kind of a good one. There was a comparison to a smartphone where it was maybe like 1/2000th or 1/5000th the power of your iPhone is the computer that was used to make Tron. But what I think kind of gets lost on people that maybe didn't see Tron in 82 or didn't see Last Starfighter in 84 is perspective. If you look back on it, having seen the new Star Wars movies, having seen Avatar, this is going to look hokey as hell. But we mentioned it when Ray Harryhausen died a couple years ago, that the stuff he was doing in the 1950s, and he did Clash of the Titans, I think came out either a year before Star Wars in 76, or it might have come out in 77. And that, compared to Star Wars, is night and day. But even then, he had been doing stop motion, being a pioneer in stop motion for, hell, 20, 30 years at that time. So what you needed to understand what Ray Harryhausen was doing, and at that time, you need that perspective. And I think that I have a little bit of that with movies from the 80s. I know what movies looked like in the 1980s. And you mentioned that it does look like a hyper-realistic video game. I mean, we didn't get video games that good till the mid to late 90s with, like, PlayStation.
Yeah, it was way ahead of its time, like, even from a video game standpoint.
Yeah.
Nintendo, Super Nintendo didn't have graphics like this. You think back to the original Star Fox, it didn't look as good as the effects here.
Polygons.
Yeah.
Star Fox looks a little bit better than the arcade last Starfighter game that he's playing, but it doesn't. The shot of the Death Blossom, like, that's kind of impressive. That's 1984. If that was direct-to-DVD in, like, the early 90s or the mid-90s, you'd be like, all right, I could see it. It's low budget. This was cutting-edge stuff in 1984, just all of the digital elements. It's not just one ship firing at another ship. There's a whole armada floating around, yeah. And this computer was able to render all of that.
When you look at it with perspective, it's impressive. If you look at it now compared to movies that you see now, or if you grew up a little later than the mid-80s, like, yeah, okay, I could see. The effects don't look great now, but if you could put yourself in that bubble, they're fantastic.
Absolutely. Like I said, I think the effects are kind of the thing that really stands out about the movie. I think it's what makes the movie unique. It wasn't necessarily the performances. They were fine, but we're all familiar with what I would call the trope of this starry-eyed teenage boy desperate to escape his dull surroundings, caught up in a mission to save the universe. Maybe it's Alex, maybe it's Luke Skywalker. They're kind of interchangeable, but I think The Last Starfighter did something at least a little bit different, where he was unwittingly recruited through playing this video game. I think that was a really interesting way to introduce him into the larger story.
Yeah, it's hard not to see Luke Skywalker at the beginning when he's yelling down the stairs to his mom, mm-hmm. like down the hill, and she's like, oh, Miss, the electric went out. Oh, Mom, that's going to take me all day. I was going to go to Silver Lake. Like,
I was going to go to Tashi Station to pick up some power converters.
It sounds like Luke Skywalker, yeah. This kid who wants to have this life, but life is holding him down. And in Luke's case, he's helping with the farm. In his case, his mom runs the trailer park, and he's kind of trying to go off to college, but he's thrust into this handyman role because he is good with machinery. And I think that's where the movie is awesome to me. I like the effects and the makeup we haven't even touched on. I think the makeup is fantastic. There's no CGI creatures. They're all makeup, and they got creative with them. I think a lot of the makeup looks really, really good. But I love the trailer park part of this movie. I always talk about world building, and you're sucked into it from the very beginning as you're going through, as Lewis is walking through the trailer park, and you're meeting all these people and you're getting all that sense of everything. And I love that part of it.
For a sci-fi movie, it's very grounded in that
respect. It is. And I love that. It grounds it very much, and it makes this trailer park is like a community, and you're sucked into that community. It's kind of a little bit overboard when he does beat the record and everybody's there cheering, but it's cute. It's fun. It fits with what you've seen already. But then there's not really a lot more to it. Like, the beta storyline is there. It relied so much on the effects that part of me wanted more of the trailer park, which I get is weird with a sci-fi movie, that I want more in the trailer park. But I really like that world that was created, especially when you throw Beta Alex into it, because I thought Beta Alex was awesome. So I just wanted to see more of that. Once it built that world, then it was a rush to get to space. And then I feel like him coming back was kind of rushed through. I feel like there was more of that human story that could have been there, but it was cut to focus on the effects.
It's hard because I guess Alex's arc, he has to leave the trailer park. Luke has to leave Tatooine. And as much as you may love that world and the cantina, we have to leave Tatooine so that we can go to the Death Star.
But Luke didn't have Beta Luke.
That's true.
And I think that was such an awesome idea.
Yeah, Beta Alex, I think, is one of the most underrated parts of this movie. It's a lot of fun. I mean, the movie has a little bit of humor in it that's not Beta Alex, but that gives it a completely different flavor. And I think the idea of having a robot that can do your mundane life while you're doing, whether it's fighting in an intergalactic war or just doing something fun, like, I imagine Ferris Bueller. Like, imagine if there was a Beta Ferris and he could have done everything he wanted to do except not have to run. It makes that movie very, very different. But I think that that concept is really cool, and I think is as appealing as having the high score in a video game and getting to go fly an actual spaceship would be to a kid. I was just as high on the idea of having a Beta Ryan. That would have been awesome.
And just,
I still want
one. I think Lance Guest is so good. I like the idea because he wasn't just playing Alex twice. Beta Alex was a completely different character. And I thought Lance Guest did really good with it. Every scene he's in just makes me laugh. Shut up, Lewis, or I'm telling Mom about your Playboys. And he leaves the room, and then he looks down at Beta Alex. Go to sleep, Lewis, or I'm telling Mom about the Playboys. Or when he just can't take it, he's like, I'm a robot. And then he gets shot in the stomach. See? Like, yeah. Just real casual.
And that was stuff that tested very well with audiences, and they went back. Because if you'll notice, Beta Alex's hair is a little bit off. Some of that stuff was shot after the movie had wrapped and Lance Guest had cut his hair. So at some point, I think he had like a wig and
you're just having a nightmare, Lewis. Just his brother's head just on the table.
That stuff is a lot of fun. And I think you're right. It was really cool. It's really kind of a neat nugget that's almost an afterthought in this movie, but it's too good to be an afterthought.
Most movies, okay, the hero gets sucked into space and that's the story. And you don't really think about the people that miss him back home.
The practicality of that.
And then, so, like, the Beta Alex addresses that. And the interaction with them was good. The interaction with him and the girlfriend. He got his hero moment. Yeah. Like, so he was there for a purpose as well. I just liked all of that. And, you know, I liked Robert Preston a lot in it. Although you just hear Harold Hill, like, as many times as I've seen The Music Man, I'm just waiting for him to bust out into 76 trombones or capital T stands for, like, that his voice is so prominent. And I really like the movie. I think whereas the technology is the star for you, like, I like the people element of it. I like Lance Guest in it. I thought he was good. I thought he was charming. He was like a young Michael Fassbender. I like that. I liked the trailer park world building. I like the stuff on with all the other starfighters where the makeup looked cool. Like, oh, sorry, I stepped on your whatever that is. I like Grig. Like, Grig was cool. I remember growing up, I always wanted a friend like Grig. I wanted the dude from Enemy Mine or Grig from Last Starfighter. Like, that's who I wanted my alien best friend to be. And I thought they were awesome. I love the people element. And I think that's why, to me, watching it, it does still stand up. Because, yeah, okay, the effect from that time span, great. But now the effects leave a little bit desired. And the story's not that fantastic. But the people in it and the ideas in it, I think, are great. And I really, really, really like it and really wish there was more. And this is the perfect kind of movie to remake. Total Recall was so far in the future that who cares? Nothing's really changed. Stuff like that, there's no reason to remake. Even Blade Runner, there's no reason to remake that. I mean, what they did was different, but
yeah,
there's
that
no
was a
reason.
Sequel.
The movies that take place so far in the future, there's no reason to remake them. But something like this, where it was way ahead of its time, it was fantastic.
Very clearly took place in the 80s. Alex goes back with the thought of rebuilding the Starfighter fleet. So, yeah, I think that that's certainly something that we could see a sequel to. I think it's been gestating for a while, like a lot of things are, and never end up getting made.
Watching this movie, it feels like a tentpole. The opening credits, the score is great. The score is very epic.
The score is way overdone. I mean, what I mean by overdone is there are instruments that they don't have any business being in a movie like this. That's a score. That's almost John Williams. Not catchy or iconic, but in terms of quality and production.
Like, I feel like it's very distinct. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, oh, I'm hearing the Last Starfighter theme, where this is the kind of theme that I feel like I'm going to hear for three or four more movies. And it's very epic and sweeping. And then you come in and it's like, it's this big epic score to open. And then, okay, now we're just at a trailer park. It feels like you're launching something. It feels like a tentpole that this is going to be a giant franchise with toys and merchandise. And it even sets
arcade
up a
games.
Sequel. It sets up a sequel, but then nothing else.
Yeah.
Last Starfighter.
Yep. That was the last. Quite literally. It almost feels like, in a way, the movie was cursed. I mean, to set up a sequel, the movie was successful. I think it was maybe in the top 25 of movies that year. I mean, it made more than it cost, so it was a profitable movie. I think it made an impact. But, you know, when Atari can't even put a Last Starfighter arcade game out, what the hell?
You know what a lot of it is? Because I looked into it.
Yeah.
Because it is the perfect movie to remake. It is the perfect movie to have a sequel, even if it was waited till the early 90s. The writer, Jonathan Buettel, he owns all the rights. When he wrote the script, he got all the rights to everything. He He just doesn't want to do it.
Went full on George Lucas.
That's it. And it's not like he's one that's had all this success. He did Theodore Rex, which is one of the biggest bombs. And if you look up worst movies in history, it's up there. And I mean, I don't know his status, but it's not like he is doing so well with his movie career that he doesn't need. He just doesn't want to. Seth Rogen tried a few years ago to get the rights. He couldn't. During his process of trying to get the rights, he talked to Steven Spielberg, who let him know, I tried to get those rights, and I wasn't able to get them. So when Steven Spielberg is trying to get your rights, and he can't even get them, I don't think anything's ever going to happen again with this. And it's a shame, because it is the perfect movie to remake. And I'm not anti-remake. I've never been anti-remake. I'm anti-pointless remakes. This one I don't think would be pointless. I think this is a cool enough story that you can build on, that you can do a franchise on, that you can introduce to a whole new world. Right. And
bring in a new starfighter who happens to find this old game at a retro arcade or whatever. Or maybe the aliens have now made an Xbox version or something like that.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where you can either just remake it completely, or it can be a Jurassic World where it's a reboot sequel, where it's a new one, but the original still exists.
And right. It takes place in the same timeline. And there's been enough time in his past. I mean, I agree with you. I think that this movie could be done today, and to have somebody like Steven Spielberg try. Yeah, okay, so we couldn't get Last Starfighter and he ended up getting the rights for Ready Player One. All right. You shoot for the moon. Sometimes you miss and you hit the stars. Okay. So he's going to do fine with this movie. But this movie, to me, fits in right with my 1980s nostalgia. And obviously, Steven Spielberg has a certain spot in his heart for that as well. But he would be the perfect kind of person, or someone like Seth Rogen is our age, who appreciates things the same way that we do. I mean, the story, to a certain extent, that Luke Skywalker hero's journey is timeless. The video game craze is not quite as big as it was in the early 80s. And certainly the movies, the video game movie adaptations, are pretty crappy, but I could see this movie doing very well. I mean, I think it'd be a fantastic kids movie. And I don't know how long you can own the rights, if it's just in perpetuity, but it's a shame. If Steven Spielberg comes knocking and he can't get it done, you're right. I don't think anybody can.
There's so much there. Like, remake it completely, continue it. You set up for a sequel. You set up these cool characters. And, I mean, your villain got away. Your main villain got away. And so there's so much story there that just, he left. He came home, got his girlfriend, and then left his life. And it's such a cool movie.
I'd like to go back to the trailer park, see Lewis, and he's been telling people for 30 years that his brother is a, you know, it's flying alien spacecraft.
And I love this movie. And you know what? Watching it again after so long, that didn't change. I did watch it twice. My kids weren't as into it as I wanted, but I liked it. I really, really like this movie, and it brought back good memories. And you know, I picked up on stuff that maybe I didn't realize before, and I just really, really like this movie. And not from a nostalgia standpoint. It's not one of those where it's like, oh, I'm going to love it because I loved it as a kid. No, it's a good movie. It's fun to watch.
To circle back around to it, that was the one thing that, you know, I think we were both kind of concerned about at the start was, are we going to like it? Does it hold up? I think the answer is a resounding yes. The technology aspect was more impressive then than it is now, but the ideas that were good, the Beta Alex stuff, the world-building stuff, that has a longer shelf life. If it was good filmmaking then, it still is now. And I do think that this is good filmmaking.
It is. It almost reminds me of MacGruber in a sense, where it's like when they're all at that meeting and it's like, oh, out of billions and billions of people in this world, you were the only ones, and there's only like 20 of them.
Yeah.
Alex leaves, and then the rest, that ship blows up, and they all die. So it's like they spent all this time like collecting these.
It wasn't as funny as it was in MacGruber.
No. Like they spent all this time collecting this small group, and then they just all died.
Yeah. Speaking of MacGruber, that group features a ton of professional wrestlers. Chris Jericho, MVP, Kane, Mark Henry, Big Show, Great Khali. What does that have to do with anything? Well, next week, John Cena's movie, Blockers, is out in theaters.
I think
theaters.
It's Rooster Blockers. Like
I thought it was Chicken Blockers.
Something like that.
Whatever.
There's a chicken on the, whatever.
Or a rooster. Or
Blockers?
Some derivation thereof will be out in theaters next week. So we thought that would be a great time. John Cena's part-time job now is professional wrestler. So we thought, let's run down our five favorite movies starring or featuring at least professional wrestlers. The list I had a lot of fun doing. Spoiler alert, there are no John Cena movies on my list.
I think I have one.
All right. And to find out what that movie is, come back and see us next week. But until then,
keep it up.